Well, today we are going to look at one of my favorite Old Testament stories. If you have a Bible, we're going to start in Nehemiah chapter 1. Kind of hard to find. It's roughly in the middle. Go to Psalms, middle of the Bible, and then to the left, three books, Job, Esther, and then Nehemiah. Some of you are probably familiar with Nehemiah's story. I hope if that's you, this is a good refresher. And for some of us who maybe we don't know this story, I think you're going to be surprised at just how applicable, how timely something is, even that's written like 2,500 years ago, to right where we are right now. And so one of the reasons that Nehemiah is so relatable and I guess accessible is because it's written in first person. And so it actually reads like Nehemiah's like a journal of what had to have been like the most incredible chain of events in his entire life. I read a book, to think about this, but like 20 years ago now, which is hard to imagine, by a pastor author named Andy Stanley. And the book is called Visioneering. And in it, he just kind of walks through Nehemiah's story. And that's for sure influencing some of what I'm sharing, but there's a point in the book where Stanley highlights a single verse that we're going to land on this morning. And this one verse has stuck with me ever since. And so I want to share it with you. But first, I'd like to give a little bit of background, context as we jump into Nehemiah's story. So in the roughly 500s BC, Jerusalem was attacked by the Babylonians. And basically, the walls, the temple, everything was destroyed, burnt to the ground. And in this process, most of the inhabitants of Jerusalem were like dragged away from Jerusalem in exile, and they were taken away to far off Babylon, modern day Iraq. Now, eventually, the Persians conquer the Babylonians, and long story short, at some point, the Persians kind of relax the rules just a little bit. And so, after 70 years of Jewish exile, the Persians allowed many of the Jewish captives to return home. But because the exile had lasted 70 years for so long, right? That meant that there were these new Jewish people who, new generations who were born into exile, who had never set foot in Israel. It's also important to remember that the return from exile, it doesn't happen all at once overnight. I mean, it took like actually several decades. And most or many gradually sort of migrated back to Jerusalem or back home. And a lot of them, again, are living or trying to carve out a new life in a place they had only heard about from like their parents or their grandparents. And there were other Jews who had kind of already had a life in Persia or other places, and so they stayed where they were. Now, our main character, Nehemiah, he actually comes in several decades after the return from exile, after this big event had actually begun. And so he's still in Persia, where he's lived his entire life. And he's a servant of the Persian king, a guy named Artaxerxes. And Nehemiah has a pretty unique job. He's the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And so what that means is he would taste the king's wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. Only one way to find out, I guess. So he's like part like bartender, part bodyguard, all in one. So Nehemiah gets word from actually his brother, who's just returned from visiting Jerusalem with another group of Jewish guys. And Nehemiah finds out from this entourage that the city of Jerusalem, even years after the return from exile has begun, that the city is still in ruins, that they haven't like put the place back together yet. There's still no real infrastructure, and it's like people are living almost like refugees, like camping out or something at home, and most likely very few of them actually remember what Jerusalem used to be like. And so they're just kind of drifting. They're unable, seemingly, to pull it together. And so here's the report that they give to Nehemiah. And it's this report that sets in motion this whole dramatic kind of sequence of events that dramatically also changes Nehemiah's life. And so these are Nehemiah's words in chapter 1, starting in verse 3. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the provinces are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." I mean, the capital, like the holy city, Jerusalem, is desolate. The massive, like the stone walls around the city are still lying in a pile. And Nehemiah finds out about this, and his response is to weep and to mourn. I mean, he goes into this big prayer asking God to like fix this mess. I mean, he's like, "God, somebody needs to do something about this," which quickly then leads him to say, perhaps I should do something about this. And so after praying, Nehemiah goes to the king, Artaxerxes, and he asks the king for permission to go to Jerusalem himself and to rebuild this wall. Now, he knows that even approaching the king with this kind of request, he's the cupbearer. This is like way out of line. Nehemiah is fully aware that, I mean, if he catches the king on an off day, all the king has to do is like wave his hand and he's executed. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 4. The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king. And you get the sense that that prayer was kind of short, like, "Help. If it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it." Now, miraculously, the king gives Nehemiah permission to begin this rebuilding project. He gives Nehemiah these like official letters approving the request, also granting Nehemiah safe passage to Jerusalem, which is like hundreds of miles away. And so Nehemiah shows up in Jerusalem accompanied by some of Artaxerxes' like army officers and cavalry. And the Jewish people there, they can tell that something is obviously up when Nehemiah rides into town. I mean, here's this Jewish guy returning to Jerusalem, strangely like flanked by these like Persian bodyguards. And they have no idea what Nehemiah is planning. Interestingly, Nehemiah takes some time to kind of survey the situation quietly. He begins formulating this plan in his mind. And then eventually, when he's ready, he says to the people in chapter 2, verse 17, he says to them, "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. They replied, 'Let us start rebuilding.' And so they began this good work." By the way, one of the themes that we see kind of all throughout scripture is that God usually chooses to work through people. I mean, God doesn't build the wall himself. Nehemiah doesn't say, "Well, you know, I prayed about it. I guess that's all I can do." No. In fact, Nehemiah doesn't even claim that God told him to go do this. He just hears about the situation and can't help but respond. I mean, I do think it's safe to say that God gave Nehemiah this huge vision. I mean, anyone else would have dismissed this as utterly impossible. And clearly God's hand is on kind of the thing where Artaxerxes very bizarrely decides to say yes, right, to Nehemiah's request. Anyway, Nehemiah carefully formulates his plan and then he announces it. And the people rally around Nehemiah in this vision. And so right away, there's all this momentum, and Nehemiah's got to be feeling pretty good at this point, right? I mean, yeah, they still have to do the work, but they've, like, right from the beginning, kind of blown through all of the non-starters to this project. I mean, you realize just weeks before this, no one would have imagined that this would be possible. And so the project is underway. The people are excited. They have a plan, right? It's easy sailing from here, right? Of course, that's not exactly what happens. In fact, from this point on, Nehemiah faces an uphill battle to see this dream accomplished. I mean, he basically has one discouraging, disheartening setback after another placed in front of him. I mean, from here on out, Nehemiah is faced with nothing but additional hassles and distractions and threats, some of them legitimate. See, there were these neighboring politicians, okay? Two guys, actually, in particular, Sanballat and Tobiah. And when they get wind of Nehemiah's plans, I mean, they get upset. I mean, why would someone want to do good for these Israelites? Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 10, when Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite official, heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. They mocked and ridiculed us. "What is this you are doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" And so as soon as they begin, Nehemiah has people, you know, mocking him. I mean, already from the beginning, they're starting to falsely accuse Nehemiah of rebelling against Artaxerxes. You know, that Nehemiah is somehow plotting a rebellion or some kind of government takeover, which of course isn't true since Nehemiah first went to the king and got his blessing to begin with. Nehemiah responds, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." So they move forward with the construction. And the scope of this project is enormous. It's like every Israelite is given a job to do. It's all hands on deck. Look at Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 1. "When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria," which is the land just to the north, "he said, 'What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices?'" In other words, what are they going to do? What are they going to do next? Like rebuild the temple? "Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah, the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they are building, even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones." I mean, no sooner do they start than they are met head on with criticism. "What do you think you're doing? You're never going to accomplish this." And by the way, it's not just these two lone guys who are stirring up trouble. There's also now an army looking on, the Sumerian army, because they're being influenced and manipulated by these two troublemakers. You got Tobiah, Sanballat's sidekick, who's like, "Oh, look at that, look at the wall. If a fox climbed up on it, it'd probably crumble." And just on and on. Okay, so maybe some criticism is to be expected. I mean, Nehemiah is an adult. He can handle this. In fact, he probably expected some opposition. He's bold, right? But he's not naive. And so Nehemiah and the people ignore the criticism and they keep working. Nehemiah 4, verse 6, he writes, "So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart." Now, it's at this point that things begin to escalate rather quickly. You have the people who were initially against Nehemiah. They started out mocking him and his crazy pipe dream, and they get to a point where they realize, uh-oh, Nehemiah might actually pull this off. And so Sanballat and the other guy, Tobiah, they take things up a notch. Look at Nehemiah 4, verse 7. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Also, our enemies said, before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. And so their physical safety is now on the line. The mockery turns into death threats. And it's all starting to wear on Nehemiah. I mean, Nehemiah's like, every time I turn around, someone else is like in a panic because they're afraid we're going to be attacked as we work. And so Nehemiah takes the threats actually really seriously. Look at verse 16. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time, I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night so they can serve us as guards by night and as workers by day. Neither I, nor my brothers, nor my men, nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. So Nehemiah has half his workers standing around with spears and swords as armed guards to protect the other half who were actually building the wall. He says that even those who go out to get supplies, they like to carry supplies in one hand and a weapon in the other. They sleep in their clothes in case they're attacked at night. They're ready for battle. And so it's like part construction crew, part army. I mean, they're on the clock 24/7 until the wall is up and the city is protected. Nehemiah chapter 6, look at this, verse 1. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. So the wall is almost finished. All that's left to do is to kind of set the gates, to finish the gates. And Nehemiah gets this invitation. I mean, the premise, I guess, being that Sanballat and Geshem and the rest of Nehemiah's enemies are inviting him to come, sit down at a table, let's talk, let's negotiate. You know when you get that uneasy feeling that something just seems a bit off? Well, Nehemiah's like, this is definitely a trap. That's his gut reaction. He says, but they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Why should I stop? Why should I come down? And I love this image of Nehemiah reminding himself of the significance of what he's doing. I mean, he says, I am completely focused on one thing and one thing only. I am getting this wall, I'm getting these gates finished. So four times he gives them the same answer. No way. But they just won't quit. And at this point, they actually decide to play dirty. And it's hard for us to fully appreciate this predicament they now put Nehemiah in. But I'm just telling you, what they do next to Nehemiah, even like the most resolute person that you know, would be tempted to waver at this. Look at verse 5. Then, the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter. Remember that. In which was written, so now Nehemiah reads this letter from his enemies. It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you, Nehemiah, and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. See, why does Nehemiah mention that this letter he receives is unsealed? See, back then you'd send a letter, and you've seen this in movies, I'm sure, where you seal it with wax. And so you'd receive a letter, and you'd immediately inspect it to make sure that the wax seal hadn't been broken or tampered with, so that no one else had read its context. Well, getting a letter like this that's unsealed, or more likely was never sealed in the first place, that's basically code for Nehemiah. You have no idea who's read this letter. It's changed hands, person to person along the way, and you know, people being people, you have no idea who's decided to take a quick peek at what's inside. Nehemiah keeps reading the letter. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now, Nehemiah, this report will get back to the king. So come, let us meet together. See, his enemies are now purposefully spreading dangerous rumors about Nehemiah all over the country. It's actually not just Nehemiah's reputation that's at stake here. It's essentially they're trying to get him killed. I mean, if this rumor that Nehemiah is setting himself up to be king, if that gets back to the king, Artaxerxes, back in Persia, Nehemiah is a dead man. But here's how Nehemiah responds. I sent him this reply. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. Nehemiah writes back, I'm not going to let you threaten or bully me. He sees like the motive underlying their action. They're just trying to scare us. They're just trying to get us off track, to make us lose heart, but like we're this close to being done. And so Nehemiah prays, God, don't let me lose my focus. Strengthen my hand so that I can complete this task. God, my reputation, I leave it in your hands. He trusts God, and then he gets back to work. And then a few verses later, he writes, so the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. And the wall is finished. Nehemiah's enemies lose their confidence. The city is now protected. And they can begin going to work on now rebuilding the temple and restoring all of Jerusalem. It's a great story, isn't it? I want to go back to that verse, that single verse I told you about at the beginning. It's Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3. And in most translations, except for the NIV, for some reason, which I've been reading from, most translations, and the best translation of what Nehemiah says is, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. See, your story is probably different than Nehemiah's. Chances are God has not called you to rebuild a wall around like an ancient city. I mean, that's actually part of our problem. I mean, God has given us things to do that aren't nearly as like immediate and tangible as like a construction project. I mean, some of us, we're trying to raise kids. I mean, we want the best for them. We're trying to instill in them good things to help them become followers of Jesus and to learn to make wise decisions. I mean, none of these hoped-for results happen overnight. They're not immediate results. It certainly takes longer than like 52 days. Or we're trying to handle conflict in a relationship in a God-honoring, loving way. Or we're attempting to make a difference through our work or through the pursuit of some calling. Perhaps we're trying to be a positive influence for Christ on the people that God has put in our lives. I mean, you realize with all of these things, it's very easy to get discouraged, distracted, or to give in to the criticism of others. And you realize that everything in your life, everything of ultimate importance, everything that truly matters takes not just effort, but it takes persistence. It takes determination. I mean, you think about pursuing health in some area of your life, whether that's physically, financially, spiritually, you know, relationally. I mean, it requires that we actually don't get too focused or too obsessed with immediate results, that we don't get discouraged by maybe the lack thereof. Nehemiah, before he even begins to work on this wall, he's immediately surrounded by all these voices saying, "Who do you think you are? There's no way you're going to succeed at this. I mean, why even try? This is destined to fail." But Nehemiah just keeps going. Four times Nehemiah says, no, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. I mean, some of us, we actually need to memorize this verse and repeat it to ourselves every day. And this is huge, actually, for all of us today. I mean, no matter what God has given you to do, and I'm talking mostly about the small things. I mean, sooner or later, for all of us, there will be distraction, there'll be discouragement. Again, we'll be tempted to give up. We'll be tempted to come down off of that section of the wall that we've been working on. I mean, for Nehemiah, these distractions were actually pretty sinister in nature, and he was able to see through those schemes pretty easily. You know, the challenge for some of us is actually sometimes our distractions come in the form of other good things, of other good opportunities at the expense of the best, at the expense of the few important things God has given us to do. You know, the important is sacrificed to the urgent. I mean, the daily grind of life is really hard on the important things because life is now, and bills are now, and crisis is now, and the important things, it's like, yeah, we'll get to those later. See, Nehemiah, with all the distractions and the criticisms and the other opportunities that came up, he never lost sight of the goal. And I don't know, perhaps he had to constantly ask himself, okay, what difference is it going to make if I finish this wall? What difference will it make if it's done? And the answer is, it'll make a big difference. I mean, you realize a finished wall would mean safety, protection, families, you know, repopulation of the city, temple worship restored, and on and on. It matters that this is finished. I am doing a great work. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have work to do. So what happens is for us, a lot of times, we get discouraged because we're not seeing the results that we want. So we lose focus. We lose conviction. We lose sight of our sense of purpose. See, I just think that like Nehemiah, there are times when we need to stop and consider the question, what difference does it make? I mean, what difference does it make, moms, dads, to pick up after your kids day after day, just trying to not like lose your patience. I mean, what difference does it make when some days it feels like all you're doing is just like surviving until nap time? What happens is you're focused on what you're not great at. You're focused on your weakness when the truth is you are making a bigger difference than you could even know. What difference will it make if I move forward in the crisis or whatever and I try my best to do the right thing, even if it costs me? What difference will it make if I stick to my priorities, my convictions? Like the things that I decided were right before the crisis, before things got muddy, before doing the right thing seemed like it was up for debate. What difference will it make if I reach out to these people? What difference will it make if I wait for the right person? And yes, I'm lonely, and yes, being single when I don't want to be has its inconveniences. But what difference will it make if I refuse to settle in this area of my life? What difference will it make if I continue to work to get out of debt? What difference will it make if I pursue health in an area of my life, if I prioritize family over work? And what I want to tell you is it matters. That you are doing a great work. Matters. Perhaps you're listening to this and you have on your heart, you have some kind of ministry, an idea, a business idea, something to serve someone, to meet a need around you. And maybe you're engaging, you've begun that, and you're not seeing the results. Like there isn't this groundswell of momentum pushing you along. And so for you, maybe you need to stop and say, you know what? Regardless of the results, I think this is something God is leading me to do, which means I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. So let me just ask you as we close, where do you need this reminder? Where do you need to remind yourself of this? I mean, it might be writing this out, typing it up, and actually putting it on your refrigerator, posting it on your mirror so that you kind of have a daily reminder. Oh yeah, I'm doing a great work. And I am not going to let discouragement, criticism, a lack of results, what they think, distraction or whatever it is, I'm not going to let any of those things pull me off of this section of the wall that I'm working on, because it matters. It matters.